Hey there, this is Future Chad, the Chad that's editing this episode. I just want to tell you two things. Number one, in the time between me recording this and right now, I received that Falim gum in the mail. And I just want to tell you, it's gross. I mentioned in the episode, and it almost sounded like a recommendation now that I've tasted it. I don't really recommend it. It's the slightest hint of mint, but it mostly tastes like gum that you've chewed all the flavor out of. And to be honest, I don't find it that much chewier than normal gum. So if you want to chew more, I would just say go find a good sugarless gum that doesn't have a lot of chemicals, or eat a lot of granola, or do both. And the second thing, I'm not sure how the audio is going to sound when this finishes going through all the processing that I'm going to do to it. But when I'm editing right now, I have some static that somehow has shown up in my setup, the setup that I've been using for years with no problem. So I don't know if I have a cord going out or something. If there is some static here and this is the first time you're listening, usually my audio quality is a little bit better. But I'm also going to cross my fingers and hope that my post-processing, all of my plugins and everything, will take care of the problem. New Science of a Lost Art by James Nestor. Yeah, it's a book about breathing. I know, it sounds boring, but we're not talking about Andy Warhol filming people while they sleep for 8 hours or watching grass grow. We're talking about something that we do 15 to 30,000 times a day, and we never even think about it. This book it's pretty personal for me. So my lead-in is it's going to be a little wide. I went through a pretty dark period a few years ago, where I was battling crippling anxiety. Now, I'm not using air quotes when I say that. Crippling is a descriptor of anxiety that we throw out all the time. But in my case, it was pretty accurate to the fullest meaning of the word. I'm talking about panic attacks while reading books, while watching TV, recording podcasts, exercising, eating sugar or carbs. All of them, they would all trigger one. And at other times during the day, my heart, it just felt like something was tumbling inside of it. Like, I don't know, like there was a hamster loose inside of my rib cage. I get electric shocks across my pecs. My heart would suddenly start skipping a beat, which is far more uncomfortable than you know if you've never experienced that. And then there was this pressure. Just, it felt like everything was pushing against my skin, like an alien was going to explode out of my chest. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. Oh, and my jaw was always tight. In fact, just talking about it right now, my jaw is feeling tight because they are not pleasant memories. As a result of that crippling anxiety, I stopped going out. I stopped doing social things. I just couldn't handle going through these things while I was in public. And I wanted to be home, you know, just in case. Because I was in constant fear that I was going to have a heart attack at any moment. And I truly believed that. I didn't think I was overindulging my fear. It felt real. And because of the food triggering things, I stopped eating all kinds of stuff. My diet became really, really limited and really boring. And it was just because sometimes I would eat something and then something would happen afterwards. And I would start to wonder, like, maybe it was that food. Maybe, you know, maybe I can't eat oatmeal. Maybe oatmeal triggers it. You know, I didn't know what was causing all this. So I was looking for connections. And because I didn't know what was causing all of it, I was obviously living in total fear. Actually, I would say it was like living like a panicked animal. Your brain operates on a completely different level. I'd start to feel like a little something in my chest, and I put my fingers on my pulse, and oh, that's too fast. I got to calm down. It's too fast. And sometimes I'd feel good. And I'd say, you know, I'm going to go for a walk. I feel okay today. I'd put on my shoes and everything and I'd leave the house and I would get to the corner and then I'd feel something was coming on. That a panic attack was almost there. See, there's a weird thing about panic attacks. You have enough of them and it's almost like an airplane. You can feel like it's about to land. There's just this fragile liminal space between about to have a panic attack and having the panic attack. So I'd feel that sensation and I'd turn right back around and come home. Because if something was going to happen, I wanted it to happen at home and not on a sidewalk. These are all horrible things to have to consider. But I felt like I had to. So you might be wondering, like, go to a doctor. Yeah, so I went to a doctor. And they told me it was all in my head. Told me to try things to relax. You know, it's my problem. I'm broken. Go fix yourself. So I tried everything I could. I mean, I was on the internet all the time looking for things to try. I tried yoga. I tried meditation. I tried positive thinking. I tried CBT. I tried CBD. Hell, I even tried The Secret. I was looking pretty much for anything to get my life back. And then, to be honest, they all helped a little bit, but not enough. Not even all of them together could hold back the tides. They could slow down a wave, but they couldn't stop the tide. Something else obviously was going on and nobody was helping me. So, like I said, I was on the internet all the time and I started getting books and stuff. I just started reading all kinds of shit. I got very friendly as well with the advice nurse, the midnight advice nurse. I'm feeling this. Is this normal? Finally, after nobody really offering any solutions, I said I wanted to see a cardiologist. I said, send me to a cardiologist. I want to have my heart checked out. If this is all psychological, then let's go. My fear is that I'm going to have a heart attack. So if I go in and they check me out and they say my heart is good, then I can't be afraid of having a heart attack anymore. And I thought maybe that would help me to turn off whatever switch had been turned on. So the cardiologist, I go in there and the cardiologist says they're going to do a stress test. Before you do the stress test, they give you some paperwork. And it's pretty much the worst paperwork that you could give someone with hypochondria and panic attacks and anxiety. Because one of the things you're signing off on this thing is that you're not going to, nobody's going to sue the hospital if you die in the middle of the test. Small chance of it happening, but they have to put it in there. And of course, when you are an anxious person, you notice that. So the stress test, essentially, they put you on this treadmill and the treadmill slowly starts going up. You know, the incline starts going up higher and higher. So you're going steeper and steeper and the treadmill's going faster and faster. And they just want to see what happens when you stress the body, when you stress the heart. So the cardiologist is in the room, but the cardiologist is like across the room. You know, this test is so routine probably for her that she's done it a million times. So she's sitting over there. I don't know what she was doing. I had my back to her. Maybe she's looking at her cell phone. But the technician is paying attention. You know, it's not like she's being negligent. The technician is there in front of the machine watching my heart rate. And I can see my heart rate. I don't think I'm supposed to, but I can see it in the corner of my eye because the monitor's right there. And being an anxious person, I'm damn curious what's going on over there. Because as the test starts getting more extreme, I'm getting tired. I mean, I'm being stressed physically. But then I feel a panic attack coming on as well. And I see my heart rate in the monitor jump. And it jumps over 200 beats a minute. And the technician, doctor, which you don't want to hear. But obviously, I'm recording this, so I was fine. They got me off the treadmill and went back down slowly. I mean, it dropped from 200 pretty quick, but it stayed in about 100 for a while, over 100 for a while. It was damn clear. from the evidence, physical evidence, that this was something more than just stress. But they still didn't know what it was. In fact, the only thing that she suggested was that I look into going on strong anxiety drugs. But don't worry about it. Your heart's healthy. So yeah, just get on some crazy anxiety drugs because it's all in your head. No way. I'm not doing that. I want to be in control of my brain. I don't want to be safe because I'm drugged up. To me, that's not a solution. That's covering up symptoms. What I wanted to know is, what's the problem? And can we fix the problem? And it was pretty clear to me that if I was going to fix the problem, I'd have to do it myself. So yeah, remember when I said I was reading all kinds of stuff? Well, every time I would discover some possible theory, I would email it to my doctor and he would shoot it down. He'd tell me why it didn't fit for me. You know, this only happens in this percentage of the population. You don't fit because of this. But then one day I found something, and it was something that he couldn't shoot down. Hey, doc, what about sleep apnea? I mean, if I'm suffocating a bunch of times a minute during the night and my body is jolting me awake with adrenaline each time to open the passageways, wouldn't that kind of caused me to become reactive during the day as well? Over years, wouldn't I become extremely sensitive to my fight or flight response, as well as any fluctuations in my pulse or my blood sugar? Yes, that's actually quite possible. We should get you tested. And for the record, yes, I do talk to my doctor like that. I'm pretty sure he hates me. But I was right. I got tested. I do suffer from sleep apnea. And while anxiety is not known as a common associative symptom of sleep apnea, it was for me. It was basically wreaking havoc with my hormone levels. So, like I said, long intro here, but I want you to understand the severity of these things that I went through and why they matter to me. A little thing like how I was breathing during the night, it caused me a year and a half of pure hell. My body and my mind were just being decimated. My cortisol levels were completely out of balance. So I was sleep deprived for years, maybe even decades, because I don't know when it started. And chemically, I was ready to spin out of control from every tiny little fluctuation in my body, from having too much sugar to maybe a slightly elevated heart rate because I was walking a little faster, or even sometimes a cup of coffee. Not even a cup of coffee, like four sips of a cup of coffee. Sometimes that would set me off. Breath is extremely important to me because I've experienced the power that breath can have over your body and over your life. It's not boring to me. The subject of breathing is not boring to me. Because here's another thing. Strapping a CPAP on my face every night, guess what? It wasn't a miracle cure. Sure, it was a huge improvement. It got me out of that danger zone that I was living in that continual state of animal instinct. But there are still issues that didn't clear up. And no, I'm not going to begin cataloging the rest of my personal medical history. But what I've told you so far is going to be the basis for what I share about this book. Breath is not an enormous tome of technical jargon. It's actually fairly short and extremely entertaining and easy to read. But it's dense. It's dense in that Nestor teaches you a lot of different things about the body and many, many different breathing techniques. So while I'm here to talk about the book, my name's not Cliff and these aren't my notes. I'm not going to outline the entire book for you. It's a damn good book. You should just read it. And if you are even the slightest bit curious about the human body, then you'll probably dig this as much as I did. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to highlight some of the things from the book that I've found helpful. things that are helping me to resolve many of the lingering issues that the CPAP didn't resolve. So, mouth breathing, what a great place to start. I'm guilty of it. I'm a mouth breather. Are you? I don't know how I picked it up, but I've been a mouth breather since I was a kid, maybe my whole life. When I was younger and I played sports, I remember football coaches, they would catch me just huffing after I would do a run. Put your arms over your head, breathe through your nose. And I'd tell them, I can't. Passageways, they're too small. Can't get enough air. And I honestly believe that for most of my life. I believe that it was just some genetic trait that I had that I'd inherited. Small nasal cavities. And I had to breathe through my mouth because I lost the genetic lottery. But guess what? Total bullshit. I wasn't born with small nose holes. Our nasal cavities, they atrophy from lack of use. They shrink up and they fill with mucus if you don't regularly breathe through them. And that mucus, it's full of bacteria. So that means you get sinus infections and allergies all the time. So at one point in the book, Nestor, who, unlike me, is a natural nose breather, he undergoes a study at Stanford in which they insert silicone plugs into his nose and they tape them in place, forcing him to breathe through his mouth 100% for 10 days. And the results of that are horrific. The difference between how your body reacts to mouth breathing and nasal breathing is actually tremendous. And it pretty much validates every mouth breather joke that you've ever heard. After just one night, Nestor's snoring increased 1,300%. Yeah, I said that right. 1,300%. And his friend, Anders Olsen, who was going through the study with him, he was worse. He went from not snoring at all to snoring for over 4 hours on the first night. Nestor also experienced a fourfold increase in sleep apnea events. You know, that pleasant collapsing airway experience that I described earlier? Yeah, four times more. And by the end of those 10 days, Nestor's snoring increased 4,820%. And he was averaging 25 apnea events every night. His blood pressure was up 13 points, which technically made him stage one hypertensive. Guess who also had high blood pressure? Yeah, you guessed it, Olsen. And guess who else? Me. Good old mouth breathing me. I have high blood pressure. Other shitty things mouth breathing does while you sleep. It dries you out. All the moisture in your body escapes out of your mouth and you lose 40% more water than nose breathers. Also makes you pee a lot. I know this one all too well. I used to get up to pee 6 to 7 times a night on average. Sometimes more, sometimes a little less, but on average. And we're not talking about getting up and there's a little trickle. We're talking full stream power washer. Big P. Is that even something people say? Big P? I thought there was something wrong with my bladder. It was so annoying that I would prevent myself from drinking any kind of liquid for at least 4 hours before I went to bed. And I would still pee 6 times before morning. Add to that all the times a minute that I was choking on my own throat. And I think you're starting to get a picture of how little I was actually sleeping. I used to think that I couldn't remember my dreams, but some nights it was quite possible that I wasn't even having dreams because I was never actually getting into a deep enough sleep to have dreams. So you might be wondering, going back to the peeing, why do mouth breathing, snoring, and sleep apnea make you pee? Well, according to Nestor, quote, during the deepest, most restful stages of sleep, the pituitary gland, a pea-sized ball at the base of the brain, secretes hormones that control the release of adrenaline, endorphins, growth hormones, and other substances, including vasopressin, which communicates with cells to store more water. This is how animals can sleep through the night without feeling thirsty or needing to relieve themselves. But if the body has inadequate time in deep sleep, as it does when it experiences chronic sleep apnea, vasopressin won't be secreted normally. The kidneys will release water, which triggers the need to urinate and signals to our brain that we should consume more liquid. We get thirsty and we need to pee more. End quote. So yeah, mouth breathing equals more snoring and more apnea, which means less sleep and worse sleep, which pretty much beats your body to hell. And guess what? If you're a mouth breather, you can't get away with a nice little nasal pillow, CPAP mask that fits under your nose like a plastic mustache. You have to get the whole, this airplane is going down mask. The one that covers your nose and your mouth. This is actually the only solution that doctors offer. I'm a mouth breather, doc. Oh, well, you need the full face model. Here you go, Darth. Good luck ever sleeping next to a warm body again. There's actually a great bit in an episode in season 2 of The Conners where Dan is avoiding sleeping over at his girlfriend's house because she's the first woman he's been with since Roseanne died, and he's embarrassed to have to put on his CPAP. Like they say in the episode, every night you're going to bed looking like Tom Cruise in Top Gun if he was an old man who couldn't breathe on his own. But even then, if you're putting on this full face mask, all you're dealing with are the apneatic events, the choking. That's it. All the other shitty stuff from breathing through your mouth, that still happens because you're still breathing through your mouth. But there is actually another option for mouth-huffing CPAPers like myself. Mouth tape. Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like. Tape that you put over your mouth to keep it shut. Sounds scary at first, at least it did to me, but we're not talking about duct tape here. This stuff comes off if you use a little bit of force to open your jaw. Just open your mouth real quick and it peels off. Not a big deal. In fact, the first tape that I used, it was actually a little too gentle of an adhesive and it would come off in the middle of the night. I'd wake up and I'll have to put on another one, damn it. With that mouth taping, then you can use the nice little nasal pillow that's comfortable and doesn't look like you're going down to the bottom of the ocean sometime soon. And the mouth tape that I'm using right now, which I like, is NextCare Sensitive Skin Tape. I'll put a link for that in the show description. It'll be an affiliate link. But yeah, for mouth breathers, the idea of being forced to only breathe through our nose, it's actually a bit terrifying. I would leave the corners of my mouth when I first started doing this. I would leave the corners of my mouth untaped just in case. But then I learned that I was actually defeating the purpose of the whole thing. I'd fall asleep and I would slip back in old habits and my body would somehow, it would find a way to breathe through the corners of my mouth that were left open from the tape. I don't know how the hell it did it. Body's pretty incredible when it thinks it needs to do something. Leaving the corners open, it wasn't going to work. I had to embrace it. I had to start taping the whole damn thing. And well, guess what? I didn't die. Still here. Turns out you can actually breathe through your nose and survive all night. And by the way, wow, what a weird feeling to wake up the first morning after sleeping for 8 hours straight for the first time in years. It's like your brain works differently. It's very, very strange. And here's another thing about mouth breathing. It physically changes you. In the 1970s and 1980s, there was this orthodontist named Egil Harvold. And he conducted an experiment similar to what Nestor and Olson took part in. Except that Egil Harvold experimented on rhesus monkeys. He kept half the monkeys in a control group And the other half, he put silicone plugs up their noses and taped them in place and forced them to breathe through their mouths. Now, the key differences between this experiment and the one that Nestor and Olson went through is that Nestor and Olson, they volunteered. The monkeys, they didn't get to sign the release form. The other key difference is that Nestor and Olson were only forced to undergo this for 10 days. The monkeys, on the other hand, were subjected to this for over 6 months, and in a later group, for over 2 years, which I'm just going to say right here, pretty fucking cruel. But despite that cruelty, and I don't know whether to say fortunately or unfortunately here, but Harvold did discover something, putting the monkeys through that. Quote, over the next 6 months, Harvold measured the animals' dental arches, the angles of their chins, the length of their faces, and more. The plugged-up monkeys developed the same downward growth pattern, the same narrowing of the dental arch, crooked teeth, and gaping mouth. End quote. And in addition to mouth breathing, physically changing your face, like it's described here, or your skull structure, you can also add to that our soft diet. Because a soft diet stunts bone development in the same dental arches and the sinus cavity, which in turn leads to chronic nasal congestion. Here's another quote. When mouths don't grow wide enough, the roof of the mouth tends to rise up instead of out, forming into what is called a V-shape, or a high-arched palate. The upward growth impedes the development of the nasal cavity, shrinking it and disrupting the delicate structures in the nose. The reduced nasal space leads to obstruction and inhibits airflow. Overall, humans have the sad distinction of being the most plugged up species on Earth. End quote. Looking at ancient skulls, some researchers started to see nasal apertures. The nasal apertures in these skulls, these ancient skulls, used to be twice as large as they are now. They used to be the size of gumdrops. And the nasal aperture is where our nasal passages connect to our throat. So that connection used to be twice as big. And about the ancient people, Nestor says, they all had enormous forward-facing jaws. They had expansive sinus cavities and broad mouths. And bizarrely, even though none of the ancient people ever flossed or brushed or saw a dentist, they all had straight teeth. In the 1830s, a researcher named George Catlin went on a 6-year journey across the Great Plains to document more than 50 Native American tribes, document the lives of nearly 50 Native American tribes. As you can imagine, just like the ancient people described before, none of these people had ever seen a dentist either, yet all of their teeth as well were perfectly straight. As Catlin said, they were as regular as keys on a piano. The natives attributed this dental perfection, I guess you could call it, they attributed this to nose breathing. In fact, nose breathing was so important to them that mothers would watch their babies sleep, and if the babies began to breathe through their mouths, they would gently pinch them shut to teach them to breathe through their nose. And while mouth breathing can be caused from chronic nasal obstruction, which I didn't know at the time was exactly what I was describing to football coaches when I was saying, the passages are too small. 40% of the population suffers from chronic nasal obstruction from stress, pollution, allergies. But Nestor claims most cases are actually caused by the ever-shrinking real estate in the front of the human skull. These smaller mouths that we have, they're also why so many of us have to have our wisdom teeth removed. Our mouths just don't grow large enough to accommodate all of the teeth that they're actually supposed to have. It's also often not big enough for our tongue. Our mouth is not big enough for our tongue, which means that the tongue has to go somewhere and it doesn't come out the front. So where else is it going to go? It goes back into our throat, which causes snoring and increases the chance of, you guessed it, sleep apnea. Nestor suggests that one way to battle some of the things is chewing. Yeah, chewing. Some of the people that he interviewed for the book believe that as a full-grown adult, you can actually still increase the size of your mouth and your jaw. And this is because of sutures. And I don't mean sutures as in you got stitched up because you got a cut. You may have noticed when looking at a human skull, or for most of us who don't have ready access to human remains, you may have looked at fake skulls for Halloween once or twice. And you may have noticed those cracks that run across the top and the sides of the skull. Those are sutures. And when we chew, those sutures, they stretch. They open up a little bit. And we actually produce stem cells when that happens, which theoretically could be converted into bone mass. If you don't know a lot about stem cells are like they're like a blank canvas. They're a cell that can become any other cell. So theoretically, if you produce stem cells there, that they could become bone mass, and then those sutures could fill with that bone mass, and it would just make your skull continually get incrementally larger. But whether that's true or not, stem cells, still good. Chewing, still good. One of the things that he recommends in the book is getting some gum. And he recommends there's a Turkish gum called Falim. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I bought some of this, or I ordered some of it. I haven't received it yet. It's supposed to be like rubber. And instead of lasting like 5 minutes like most gum, it will last over an hour. So you can really exercise those jaw muscles. And I don't know about you, but when I think about like developing larger bone structure in the face and more prominent jaws, I can't help but think of incels and how they complain about their bone structure. So maybe they might want to buy some Falim gum, or maybe they want to look into some of these weird jaw exercisers on YouTube. Have you seen this? They can look into those, or maybe they can look into some of the dental devices. Is there some people that have developed these dental arches that you can put in that will slowly, over time, expand your jaw? But I guess maybe I probably shouldn't even mention incels, considering that my name is Chad. And everybody they hate, they refer to as a Chad. But that thing with chewing. Our ancestors, when you think about it, our ancestors, they were chewing a lot more than we are. You know, they didn't have processed foods. They didn't have stuff that had been chopped up and made soft. Even bread, like 100 years ago, even bread was hard. It was like a brick. If you go back far enough, the ancestors, when we use the word ancestors, those people were eating food that probably had dirt and rocks in it. Not to mention they were eating a lot of dried meats, leathery hides, a lot of chewing. Whereas we, like I said, have lots of soft processed foods and lots of sugar, which explains why cavities are so common now and why they were so rare before industrialization. You ever wonder why before dentistry, everybody didn't just die all the time from infected or abscessed teeth? I mean, if they were never going to dentists and cavities were as common then as they are now, then everybody, before they got to like 10, 12, would have had an infected tooth. And if you've ever had an infected tooth, which I have, and it's miserable, you know that the only thing that's going to do it is dentistry and antibiotics. Even if you rip a tooth out, sometimes the root's still infected and you still need the antibiotics. So why didn't everybody just die? And the truth is probably because nobody had cavities. The soft diet, the sugar brought the cavities. Think back again to those native people with perfect teeth, like pianos. Another thing about nose breathing is our sinuses. You might never have thought about this, but our sinuses, it's not like a straight shot. You know, our sinus actually, the nose doesn't just go to the back of the throat. It loops through our cheek and goes through other parts of our head. It's shaped to filter air that comes in. It filters it in a way that the mouth doesn't. Not to mention there's all that cilia, that those hairs up there that grab stuff. The mouth and the throat, they don't have that. As Nestor explains, in a single breath, more molecules of air will pass through your nose than all the grains of sand on all of the world's beaches. Trillions and trillions of them. These little bits of air come from a few feet or several yards away. As they make their way towards you, they twist and spool like the stars in a Van Gogh sky. And they'll keep twisting and spooling and scrolling as they pass into you, traveling at a clip of about 5 miles per hour. What directs this rambling path are turbinates, 6 maze-like bones, 3 on each side, that begin at the opening of your nostril and end just below your eyes. The turbinates are coiled in such a way that if you split them apart, they look like a seashell, which is how they got their other name, the nasal concha, after the conch shell. Crustaceans use their elaborately designed shells to filter impurities and keep invaders out. So do we. End quote. And another benefit is that our sinuses release nitric oxide. And nitric oxide improves circulation and the oxygenation of cells. It positively influences our immune system, our weight, our moods. When we breathe through our nose, we produce 6 times more nitric oxide, which translates to 18% more oxygen absorption. Oh, and did I mention that nitric oxide also opens capillaries in the genitals, which is exactildwhat the drug sildenafil does? You might know sildenafil better as Viagra. And if that appeals to you, you may also want to try humming, as in singing with your mouth closed. Humming also ups your nitric oxide production. This time, an additional 15-fold. Maybe instead of singing Viva Viagra in an empty bar, all those middle-aged men in the commercial, maybe they should have been humming in the shower. Just a thought. But probably my biggest takeaway from this book is that many of us are overbreathers. We breathe too fast. We're bringing in more oxygen than our body can handle, either because of mouth breathing or simply just inhaling too many times every minute. And not only can we not process this fast enough, but it has detrimental effects. Too much oxygen is not good for us. And I can completely attest to that fact. Something about being in front of the computer screen, for some reason, it causes me to breathe twice as much as I normally do. I sip air. I don't know I'm doing it. I catch myself doing it all the time. If I don't catch myself and stop it, then when I get up from the computer, I feel like complete shit, to be honest. My heart rate will be racing, my blood pressure will be high, and I will be completely anxious. It's not pleasant. And that's just from oxygen. But we need oxygen. But we also need carbon dioxide. Anders Olsson even suggests at one point that carbon dioxide is more important than oxygen. And there are a bunch of reasons for this. But the main one is that carbon dioxide helps us to actually use oxygen, to use the oxygen we inhale, which means by breathing slower, even when we're exercising, we increase the carbon dioxide in our bloodstream, and that in turn allows us to absorb the oxygen that we have breathed in better, and we need less of it. Now, when I do these book reviews, I don't do a lot of quoting. In this book, it's hard to not quote, because some of the things can't be described better than he describes it. But one of the things I definitely never do is read long passages. But I'm going to read a longer passage right now, because Nestor's description of this process, it's perfect. Actually, after reading it, it completely allowed me to competently understand how the breathing process works. So I want to share it with you as I read it, and hope that it will do the same thing for you, that it will give you the same understanding. Each breath you take must first travel down the throat, past a crossroad called the tracheal carina, which splits into the right and left lungs. As it keeps going, that breath gets pushed into smaller tubes called bronchioles until it dead ends into 500 million little bulbs called alveoli. What happens next is complicated and confusing. An analogy may help. Let's say you're about to take a river cruise. You're in a waiting room at the dock when a ship approaches. You pass through security, board the ship, and head off. This is similar to the path oxygen molecules take once they reach the alveoli. Each of these little docking stations is surrounded by a river of plasma filled with red blood cells. As these cells pass by, oxygen molecules will slip through the membranes of the alveoli and lodge themselves inside one. The cellular cruise ship is filled with guest rooms. In your blood cells, those rooms are the protein called hemoglobin. Oxygen takes a seat inside the hemoglobin. Then the red blood cells journey upstream, deeper into the body. As blood passes through tissues and muscle, oxygen will disembark, providing fuel to hungry cells. As oxygen offloads, other passengers, namely carbon dioxide, the waste product of metabolism, will pile aboard, and the cruise ship will begin a return journey back to the lungs. This exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide changes the appearance of blood. The blood cells in the veins that carry more carbon dioxide will appear blue. Arterial blood, still filled with oxygen, will appear bright red. It's these gases that give the veins and arteries their distinctive colors. Eventually, the cruise ship will make its rounds through the body and back to port, back to the lungs, where carbon dioxide will exit the body through the alveoli, up the throat, and out the mouth and nose in an exhale. More oxygen boards in the next breath, and the process starts again. Every healthy cell in the body is fueled by oxygen, and this is how it's delivered. The entire cruise takes about a minute, and the overall numbers are staggering. Inside each of our 25 trillion blood cells are 270 million hemoglobin, each of which has room for four oxygen molecules. That's a billion molecules of oxygen boarding and disembarking within each red blood cell cruise ship. End quote. I don't know about you, but for me, that's a perfect analogy. It made it so clear for me how this works. And every time that I've thought about the breathing process since first reading that passage, that exact image of this cruise ship came into my mind. And I think it probably always will. That's some damn good writing. Okay, what we're going to do now is do a lightning round. These are three quick things from the book that I can't do this episode without mentioning them, but I don't really want to create some artificial narrative to connect these three things together. So we're going to do them as a list. One, two, three. Okay. Number one, Buteyko breathing, or the Buteyko technique. I was actually familiar with this before reading this book, but I was using it mostly as a way to relax and fall asleep, which are both one of the many benefits of increased carbon dioxide in the body. But here's the thing about carbon dioxide. We have tolerance levels. There are chemoreceptors in our body that tell us when we're getting too much carbon dioxide. This is actually what happens when you hold your breath in and you feel the need to exhale. This isn't because you're rushing to get oxygen. You already have oxygen. It's in your lungs. What you're actually feeling is the need to exhale carbon dioxide. So for the most part, these chemoreceptors, they're pretty awesome, except when they get screwed up, when they get calibrated wrong, like they are for me. I'm not positive, but this might be caused from years of sleep apnea. But my air hunger level, my air hunger threshold, it's really small. It doesn't take long for me to feel like I'm suffocating. When I fully exhale and wait to breathe, I can't do that for very long. Maybe 6 seconds when I first started testing this. 5-6 seconds was max. So yeah, I'm pretty sure choking on my own throat 6 times a minute for 8 hours over many years probably trained this panic into my chemoreceptors. And this is where the Buteyko technique comes in. It helps you to retrain your chemoreceptors, slowly stretching your resistance back out to where it belongs. And actually, after reading this book, I discovered that there are actually several techniques named after Buteyko. But this is the main one, and it's the one that I use several times a week. And it's pretty easy. Basically, you just breathe in naturally, breathe out naturally, breathe in for 2 seconds, and then breathe out for 6 seconds. and then you hold it for 6 seconds. Hold that exhale or that post exhale for 6 seconds, like I'm doing now. And then start the cycle over. Breathe in naturally. Breathe out naturally. Breathe in for a 2 count. Breathe out for a 6 count. Hold for 6. And you go through that cycle at least 10 times. Typically, I aim for 20. And when I do that, I actually try to extend my exhales and my hold for longer. So for a while, I would do the in, out, 2, 6, 6. And then after a while, I would go breathe in, breathe out, 2 seconds, out for 7, hold for 7. And then maybe after a while of doing that, I would do everything the same, except I would breathe out for 8 seconds and hold for 8 seconds. And just keep doing that to see how far I can go to really stretch my body's ability to deal with carbon dioxide. And I can say that after doing this for a month and a half, maybe about, that my average threshold of holding my breath has gone from 6 seconds up to 10. That's an average. Sometimes I can go higher, sometimes a little bit lower. It just depends on how often I'm practicing. But I'm pretty happy with that progress. Number 2, Hungarian scientist Albert St. Georgi proposed that human beings can actually rust. If our cells lose the ability to attract oxygen, then their electrons will slow down and they will no longer jump interchangeably between other cells. And that leads to abnormal growth in the cells. We call this rusting that happens cancer. And that explains why cancer thrives in low oxygen environments. Number 3, researcher Justin Feinstein has a theory that people with anxiety are involuntarily holding their breath throughout the day. When their carbon dioxide levels get too high, those chemoreceptors we were talking about, they tell the brain that it's suffocating. And then the people find themselves suddenly gasping for air. They don't know why. And of course, that automatically leads them into a panic attack. So then after going through this for a while, the body says, you know what? Screw this. You know what? I'm going to be more vigilant. I'm just not going to relax. I'm going to constantly stay on edge. I'm going to be continually alert. And I'm not going to let that underbreathing thing, I'm not going to let that happen. In fact, I'm not going to let carbon dioxide get high at all. I'm going to breathe twice as much as normal. I'm going to overbreathe. Feinstein says it could be that anxiety at its root isn't a psychological problem at all. End quote. Which to someone who has gone through all of this like I have, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. And that's the end of the lightning round. And that's it for Breath by James Nestor. I keep wanting to say Breathe by James Nestor. Breath by James Nestor. And actually, I'm leaving a lot of the book out, like 90% of the book. In fact, I'm leaving out some of my favorite parts of the book because they require knowledge of the rest of the book to actually make sense. But I do have one other thing to leave you with. And this is actually my favorite story from the book. I'm not going to do it justice. It'll be better when you read it in the actual book. But this is a story of Carl Stowe. Carl Stowe was a choir conductor in the 1940s in New Jersey. And in his choir conductor duties, he was teaching singing to the choir members. And in doing that, he noticed that some of his students were gasping for air between measures. You know, they would sing, 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 suck in as much air as they possibly could. And he also noticed those same people had weak singing voices. So Stowe began training them to exhale properly, to push out all of the air and not just some of it. He taught them to build up their respiratory muscles and enlarge their lungs. It was something that I guess he just innately understood because he wasn't a doctor or a scientist. He just understood the mechanics of the lung from singing and teaching singing. And those gasping singers that he was teaching these techniques to, the ones with the weak voices, they started to improve dramatically. Their voices got strong and they weren't running out of air between measures. Sometime after this, Stowe moved from New Jersey to North Carolina, where he started to use those same techniques to train church choirs. And these church choirs, well, they got pretty damn good. They started winning awards and national competitions, which meant that word got around about Stowe. And after hearing about what he'd accomplished, the Metropolitan Opera asked him if he would move to New York and retrain their singers in proper breathing techniques, which of course he did. And then in 1958, Dr. Maurice Small from the East Orange Veterans Affair Hospital in New Jersey called Stowe on the phone. He called him to ask him if he would work with the emphysema patients at their hospital, saying to Stowe, "You must know something about breathing that we don't." When Stowe got to the hospital, he saw awful conditions. The awful conditions of the patients, not of the hospital. As Nestor writes, dozens of patients were laid out on gurneys, each one jaundiced and pale, their mouths craned open like fish, oxygen tubes pumping to no avail. The hospital staff didn't know what to do, so they just wheeled the men across the waxed terrazzo floors and into a room hung with faded yellow tissue dispensers and American flag clocks, one patient beside the other, waiting to die. It had gone this way for 50 years. End quote. And one of the things that the nurses in this hospital were doing to try to help these patients, because they cared, they just didn't know what to do, they would put pillows under their backs to arch up their chests to make it easier for them to inhale. But after being there a while, Stowe soon figured out that inhaling wasn't actually these patients' problem. Their problem was exhaling. They weren't getting enough of the old air out of their lungs to take in fresh air. And the pillows were actually making that situation worse. He also discovered that these patients, their diaphragms weren't working properly. Quote, "My activities looked silly when observed from a distance. And they seemed silly at the outset to the person with whom I worked," wrote Stowe. He'd begin the treatments by putting patients flat on their back, on his hands across their torsos, and gently tapping on rigid muscles and distended chests. He'd have them hold their breath and count from 1 to 5 as many times in a row as they could. Next, he massaged their necks and throats and lightly coaxed their ribs as he told them to inhale and exhale very slowly, trying to wake the diaphragm from its long slumber. Each of these exercises allowed the patients to let out a little more air so that a little more air could get in. After several sessions, some patients learned to speak a full sentence in a single breath for the first time in years. Others began walking. One elderly man who had not been able to walk across the room not only could walk, but could walk up the hospital stairs, a remarkable feat for an advanced emphysema patient, Stowe wrote. Another man who hadn't been able to breathe for more than 15 minutes without supplemental oxygen was lasting 8 hours. A 55-year-old man who had suffered advanced emphysema for 8 years was able to leave the hospital and captain a boat down to Florida. End quote. But the thing here is, even though it sounds like it, Stowe, he wasn't actually curing their emphysema. He was teaching these people to use the full capacity of their lungs. So that lung damage, the emphysema, the lung damage, it remained. But they just learned to work around it by using the rest of their lungs, which they weren't doing before. It's kind of similar to how brain damage patients are able to route mental functions around damaged areas of the brain. It's really incredible what he was able to accomplish. What a choir director could discover that all these doctors at the time couldn't, and not from a lack of trying. And there's more to that story, but I'm going to leave that for you to read on your own. And when you read the book, you also find out what I mean when I say that nostrils have erectile tissue. Dun, dun, dun. I'm sure you can tell. I really love this book. Beyond the fact that it's given me a bunch of things to try out to improve my own breathing, it was just a lot of fun to read. So if you pick up a copy, or if you've already read the book, go find Semi-Literate Pod on Instagram and let me know what you think about breathing and breathing techniques, plugging your nose, taping your mouth, James Nestor. Let me hear it. Also, I'm going to include an Amazon affiliate link in the description of the episode. If you decide to buy the book, I'd appreciate if you use the link. It costs you exactly the same, but instead of Amazon getting all your money, I get a tiny bit of that, which pays for health insurance and the internet and food.